And the title of my talk is Information the Key, is taken from a paper that I published in the inaugural issue of Nature Physics, in which it really was a commentary, not a real paper. And there I asked the following question, really. Let me read it. Do the truly fundamental laws of nature concern not waves and particles, but information? And of course, you all guessed that my answer is yes, or at least my belief is yes. And this works. Good. However, I was certainly not the first person to ask this question. Neither was Chris. However, Chris Fuchs certainly is the person who got me infected with this question. He spent a year in Montreal a long time ago, and we discussed these issues. And in particular, I was extremely influenced by this paper, in which Chris admits that he just wants to make trouble. And in this paper, Chris really, I think it's sort of one of the most beautiful ways of stating the question or posing an agenda. Specifically, Chris asks, he tells us that the task that's ahead of us is not to make sense of quantum axioms as they are currently taught in physics departments who don't know much about quantum information, I mean, true physics, old core physics. So they have quantum axioms. When they think in terms of axioms, which they probably don't. And the task, says Chris, is not to make sense of the quantum axioms by heaping more structure and more definitions and more science fiction on top of them, but rather it's to throw them away wholesale and start afresh. Throw away all our conceptions of quantum mechanics. Not that it's wrong. It's just based on foundations which are ad hoc and disjointed. This is my saying. Chris doesn't have to agree with being so strong about it. I don't know if he does. But still, the point is that we should throw away the axioms as they are being taught in physics departments wholesale and start afresh. And what we would, the question is really from what deep principles might we derive this exquisite structure? Because it is exquisite. And now this is the only point maybe where Chris and I disagree. As you see, he wrote physical principles. I would say informational principles. And then is the best part of this quote from Chris, that these new principles that we're all here to derive should stir the soul. Good. Now, Chris is, as I said, he certainly was not the first person to ask these questions. In particular, in fact, he himself got infected from Wheeler. Wheeler, he spent a year or so with Wheeler, and when Chris was with Wheeler earlier than 2000, much earlier than 2000. But in 2000, Wheeler wrote in the New York Times that quantum mechanics is very successful, all is wonderful, but still, there's kind of a shame that we don't understand where it comes from somehow. And Chris tells me that, in fact, as early as the late 70s, Wheeler already was telling students to work on foundations. And that students who would come to him, even undergraduates, he would tell them, the best students, of course, he would tell them to find information theoretic foundations for quantum physics, late 70s. And some of the students infected by Wheeler at that time, in addition to Chris, of course, there's Bill Wooders, Zurich, Schumacher, and a few more, certainly. Okay. Now, let me quote someone else who believes in this program, I believe he's here. I haven't seen him yet, but yeah, there's Jeff. This is another paper I like very, very much, in which Jeff Boob says that quantum mechanics is fundamentally a theory about the representation of and manipulation of information, not about waves and particles, and that the notion of quantum information is to be understood as a new physical primitive. I know I'm preaching to the people who already believe, or probably most of you, in these things, but still, it's good to see that these ideas have been around. They're not all that new. The idea that one should or could think of quantum mechanics in terms of information as being the main primitive is not new. But now it's booming, as this room, overflowing room, proves. It's becoming more and more interesting and followed. So, now, this, of course, we can go even further back. Now, I'm certainly not saying that Einstein believed that quantum mechanics was based on information, but Einstein was also wanted to find foundations for physics and nature. He might not agree with us all that much because, he said that all of us pretty much know the basic axioms, or have some idea what the basic axioms in physics would turn out to be. But in 1948, Einstein wrote, "That's certainly not the quantum." All right. Now, let me be more specific as to why I find this topic of quantum foundations based on information so interesting. If you look at relativity, at least special relativity, you will see that the axioms of relativity are really quite simple. Well, the speed of light in empty space is independent from the speed of its source. And physics should appear the same in all inertial reference frames. And it's mostly true that if you only start with these two principles, and if you're an Einstein, you can derive special relativity, and maybe even more than that. Now, compare that with quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics... This is taken from one of Charlie's slides, Charlie Bennett. I don't know if some of you might remember the late Tom Beth, who used to think that these are tombstones. They're not tombstones. These are the tables of the law that God handed to Moses, as opposed to what you've been taught in grade school. God wrote these laws. About quantum mechanics. At least that's again what we're being taught in normal physics departments, who don't care about quantum information. That these are the laws of quantum mechanics, and it goes on and on. It's completely disjointed. It's somewhat unnatural. And the question really is, why is that? Why did God hand and this is not Moses, of course, but that's good enough. You might think it's Adam. It's really Bob. Alice will come in a minute. Really, the question that really interests me is, why did God hand these laws to Bob of quantum mechanics, those in the tombstones? Whereas he gave Einstein such simpler laws for relativity. It's kind of unfair. And what I believe is not because relativity is fundamentally simpler than quantum mechanics. It's because relativity came to one person over a relatively short period of time, whereas quantum mechanics was derived over tens of years by many people. Each one of them wanting to add their own stone to the edifice. So that's probably why it's so disjointed. And my deepest belief is that it's time, in fact, it's been time for at least 10 years, to just take a pause and look back at what has been accomplished in the 20th century and distill from all this beautiful, exquisite theory, distill what is truly fundamental. And from what has been distilled as truly fundamental, to rebuild the edifice. In other words, to take the current foundations, which work well, but they came about as a disjointed set by many people. And from that, from there, to find what is truly fundamental. I'm sorry to repeat myself. And then take them out, single them out, and rebuild rebuild the theory from that point. And so at some point, I was in the Sistine Chapel. Oops, sorry. I hope it's going to come back. Okay, good. So I was in the Sistine Chapel, and I had a dream. And my dream was that God handed to Bob, or rather, God had just created Bob, and asked him, "All right, Bob, hope you're happy. What would your heart most desire?" And Bob thought for a while and answered, "Confidentiality." Now it's kind of silly because Alice had not been created yet, but still. So Bob asked God for confidentiality, and God said, "Let there be confidentiality," and that was good. And then God created Alice, and asked her, "What do you want?" And not surprisingly, Alice answered, "Commitment." So God said, "All right, let there be commitment." But then all hell broke loose. And so God had to backtrack and tell Alice, "I'm sorry, I can't do that. Confidentiality is possible, but commitment is not." And so that's why at that point, God realized that he had no choice and he had to invent quantum mechanics. All right. You understand I'm not entirely serious, but, and I lied, I did not have this dream in the Sistine Chapel, but I had it while talking to Chris, actually. What is serious about this story is that it would be wonderful if the entire edifice of quantum mechanics could be built just as relativity on only two principles, and being very self-centered, I would find it wonderful if these two principles were that quantum cryptography is possible but quantum bit commitment is not. Unfortunately, this dream was squashed by, just want to make it sure that you realize that I'm not the first person to make God enter foundations. Einstein said something like this, I've never been able to find the actual source, but I've been told several times over that Niels Bohr's answer to Einstein was really adequate. It turns out that this dream, as I gave it to you, cannot be fulfilled because John Smolin proved that you cannot cannot build quantum mechanics only on those two principles. Essentially, John Smolin invented a toy model of the world in which confidentiality, unconditional confidentiality is possible and commitment is not, and yet that world is anything but quantum mechanics. So you cannot build quantum mechanics only on those two principles. But it could be a good start. And at some point I was visiting Jeff Boob in Baltimore, and I was telling him about these ideas. It was probably in the early 2000. And he got excited about it, and he talked to Clifton, and he brought in Halverson. And in any case, at some point, they started working on these ideas, and it's one of the first successes, I would say, of this program. So this was my dream. Build quantum mechanics from conventionality and no bit commitment. They couldn't quite do that. They replaced confidentiality being possible by faster than light information transfers impossible. And they added that perfect broadcasting is impossible. Now, perfect broadcasting is somewhat similar to cloning. Broadcasting is somewhat similar to cloning. Broadcasting is cloning. No cloning says that from some pure state psi, you cannot make two copies if you don't know what psi is. That's no cloning. You all know that. Broadcasting would say, and it's not possible, that you take from a mixed state and you output two systems of the same dimensionality, not two copies of rho. To make two copies of rho would be even harder than cloning, because you would have to do that even for mixed states. What broadcasting means is that from one mixed state you make something, so that if you trace out either side, you get the mixed state back. So it's somewhat easier to do than cloning. But broadcasting is also impossible. This was one of the early results of Chris Fuchs and others, and really quite beautiful that you cannot do that. And for instance, if you wanted to broadcast a completely mixed state, producing a singlet would do the job, which is clearly not cloning. Anyways, so back to Boob, Halverson, and Clifton. From these three axioms, they did not quite derive quantum mechanics. They needed to add something which I find somewhat less pleasant, which is that the universe is ruled by Cesor algebras. Nothing that is not natural, but what I really want are purely information theoretic axioms, and that's not information theory. It's algebra, it's mathematics, it's nice, but it's not in my wish list. Let's put it this way. And furthermore, they didn't drive the whole of quantum mechanics, but some properties, like entanglement. So they were able to get entanglement as a consequence of information theoretic statements plus something algebraic. But of course, at this point, we have to ask ourselves if God really said that also. Well, I lied to you a little bit. I mean, I wish we did not need to say that we could do everything only based on information theory. But on the other hand, when I said that Einstein derived the entire, actually special relativity from only these two axioms, it's not exactly true. If you look at his paper, which has if you look at his famous paper that started relativity, which goes by this completely horrible title, not horrible because it's in German, horrible because when you translate it, it says nothing of any interest. This is the title of the paper that started special relativity. But if you look at this paper, you will see that, in fact, he said that, well, of course, there are these two axioms. I'm not saying that he pursued axiomatically, but also it would be based on the kinematic of the rigid body, and of course going to be linear, and all kind of stuff in addition to these two axioms. So you don't get relativity just from these two axioms. You need to assume some more stuff, which is not information theory. So to assume that the universe is linear, or to assume this is seesaw algebra, it's not that much worse. But still, what I really want is to find theorems that I really believe are fundamental, theorems in information theory, in quantum information, that I really believe are fundamental, and see which one of those would deserve to be promoted to the rank of axiom. So let me switch gears a little and tell you about communication complexity and non-local boxes. So a non-local box is a device. It's a creation of the mind. It's not something that exists in nature, but it's really interesting to think about them. So a non-local box would consist of, in fact, we call it one non-local box, but it's really two boxes, which are arbitrarily far apart. And Alice and Bob each have one side of the box, or one of these two boxes, but it's really only one non-local box. And if Alice and Bob input bits X and Y to these boxes, they will get out bits A and B as outcome. And the non-local box is defined so that the inputs are bits chosen by Alice and Bob, or they might be imposed upon them from the outside. The outputs are two bits which are completely random when seen individually. The marginal probability of A is uniform, 0, 1. Same thing for B. However, there is a condition, a joint condition, which is that the exclusive or if you wish, the sum modulo 2 of A and B is equal to the conjunction or the AND of X and Y. So if X and Y are both 1, the AND is 1, which means that A and B must be different for the XOR to be 1. In the three other cases, if X and Y are not both 1, then the AND is 0, and the XOR means being 0 means that the two bits are the same. So the two output bits are the same or are different depending on the inputs with this equation. Now, it turns out that these non-local boxes cannot be used to communicate. Meaning, if Alice and Bob have these boxes in their labs, there's nothing Alice can do to signal something to Bob, at least not instantaneously, because regardless of what Alice puts in as X in her box, the output B of Bob, seen from Bob's marginal point of view, is purely random and uniform. It's not no influence from what Alice put in. So these boxes cannot be used to communicate. We say that they are causal for that reason. They're also atemporal, atemporal meaning that as soon as Alice puts in her input, she gets the output, regardless of whether Bob has done his side of the game yet or not. So there is no time between Alice and Bob here. When you put in the input, you get the output, and then there is this connection, which is mysterious and, in fact, not physical. Now, it's fairly easy to simulate these boxes with a 75% success rate in classical physics with no communication, just by having strategies that you agree upon. Alice and Bob agree ahead of time on these strategies, and they can simulate this box and be right 3 times out of 4. And if you use quantum mechanics, you can be right about 85% of the time. The cosine square of pi over 8, about 45%. 85%. And it's fairly easy. I mean, it's entirely easy with quantum mechanics to get this 85% success rate. It takes some more work to prove itself that you cannot do any better. It's a consequence of one of Cyrilson's theorems. It's not trivial, but you cannot do any better with quantum mechanics. And now we have so this is a theorem. It's a theorem that you can do it 85% of the time. It's a theorem you cannot do it any better. These are theorems from what I call the old axioms. But is that truly fundamental? Should this limit of 85% be considered, this is the axiom from which we want to derive some less primitive things which are thought of as being axioms today. And this all comes about because of entanglement. And Schrödinger was really, really amazing at understanding early on in 1935 the importance of entanglement. In fact, if you look at his own notes, which Arthur Eckert has done with since several students to study Schrödinger's old handwritten notes, it seems that entanglement was discovered by Schrödinger several years before 1935. In any case, entanglement is, of course, at the core of making these non-local, simulating these non-local boxes with an 85% success rate. Now, the question is, I'm willing to grant to Einstein that nature is local, or at least that there is no instantaneous action, that at least no instantaneous communication is possible. Let's put it this way. And therefore, a non-local box, if it existed in our world, it would have to be causal, meaning that cannot be used to communicate instantaneously. But and we know that quantum mechanics allows for these non-local correlations, which cannot be used to communicate. And the question is, this non-local box I described offers a very strong, in fact, in a formal sense, the strongest possible type of non-local correlation. But quantum mechanics doesn't allow it. This non-local box, if it worked 100% of the time, would be perfect. And quantum mechanics, if it only worked 75% of the time, it would be completely local, in a sense, because it could be simulated with classical physics. But in our universe, as far as we understand it, we can build these non-local boxes which are correct, which work 85% of the time. So they're more non-local than if they were completely local, but they're not maximally non-local. And the question is, why? Why did God stop at 85%? Let's put it this way. And to partly answer this question, now let me tell you about communication complexity. This is old stuff, but if you have not seen that, I think you'll be interested. If you have, well, take a break. Communication complexity was invented in the classical world by Abelson in 1978, I think. Don't quote me on that. 1 year before, it became much better known due to a paper of Andrew Yao. Andrew Yao, who, by the way, gives full credit to Abelson. And in the classical world, communication complexity works as follows. You have two people. Of course, we're calling them Alice and Bob. And Alice and Bob have some inputs, X and Y, which may come from the outside. And they want to compute some function f of x and y. Now, this is a purely cooperative game. There's no cryptography whatsoever here. Alice is not trying to hide x from Bob. That's not the point. The point is that they get their inputs. They both want to compute f of x, y. They cooperate, but they want to communicate as little as possible. So at the end of the day, Alice will compute, will know the value. And the purpose is, maybe both of them will know it. And to do that, they will exchange classical bits, because we're in a classical case. And the purpose is to minimize the number of bits of communication. This is a very well-established field in theoretical computer science. Nothing quantum here yet. For us, the really exciting question to ask is, does the situation change if Alice and Bob are allowed to be entangled, to share prior entanglement? The question was asked by Cleve and Berman, and the answer, came that yes, if Alice and Bob can share entanglement, then Nothing else changes. And the answer is yes. With entanglement, the amount of communication required can drop exponentially. There are, not always, but there are some problems for which we can prove that you need so much communication classically to do it, if you're purely classical. But if alphabet were entangled, they can do the same with exponentially smaller amount of classical communication. It's still classical communication, but just by being entangled with exponentially smaller amount of communication, they can do it. And we have examples in both in the model where you require the answer to be correct, absolutely no error permitted, and also in the much more interesting and difficult scenario where you tolerate a small error, epsilon error rate. In both cases, you get exponential gain by allowing entanglement. So that's a very, very nice field of quantum information. And it turns out that, and I'm going to define a function to be trivial, a Boolean function to be trivial, if with a single bit of communication you can compute it. These are the functions which are very, very easy to compute with communication. Of course, those that can be computed with zero bits of communication are even more trivial because, in fact, they are of no interest. These are those for which Alice's output does not depend on. Alice can compute her output by looking at her input with no, even in classical case, with no communication, regardless of Bob's input and vice versa. So those that require zero bits are not interesting. So one bit is the trivial case, and I just said that. And it turns out that we can prove some Boolean functions are non-trivial. It's not very difficult. I mean, it's not so easy to prove that they're non-trivial, but they are very, very natural functions of two inputs. Alice and Bob have the inputs. And it's not possible, even if you're entangled, it's not possible with a single bit of communication to compute them. For instance, is x equal to y? You cannot decide if x equals to y with a single bit of communication, even if you're entangled. So the question again is quantum mechanics must be causal. We agree with Einstein on that. It allows for these non-local correlation, which are instantaneous. And the question was, why is quantum mechanics not as non-local as it could be, yet remaining causal? And a really nice answer was given by Wim van Dam and independently by Richard Cleave, which is that in this paper here, that's in Van Damme's thesis, in 2000 or so. We've seen this already. And Van Damme's result, and again, Cleave's independently, is that if non-local boxes existed in the real world, if we could harness them, they would make it possible to compute all functions, all Boolean functions, with a single bit of communication. It's really quite surprising. It's not very hard to prove, but it's beautiful and surprising. Any Boolean function can be computed with a single bit of communication between Alice and Bob if these non-local boxes were to exist. So in a sense, this gives a purely computer science, theoretical computer science answer to the question, why didn't God go all the way in allowing quantum mechanics to be, even though causal, to be non-local? Why didn't God provide for non-local boxes, perfect non-local boxes in his universe? And the computer science answer is because otherwise he would have made communication complexity trivial, and that would have been a shame. You're not obliged to follow me in finding more fundamental computer science than the old axioms of quantum mechanics. It's a matter of taste, of course. But still, I like to think that if you could compute all Boolean functions with a single bit of communication, it would really be a dull world, and that God was right in not making it possible. So this explains why non-local boxes cannot be perfect in our universe. It does not explain this 85% or cosine squared pi over 8 probability of success that we can get. After all, in the classical world, we would have had 75%. So what's more fundamental about 85 than 75? That's a question I find really interesting. Nevertheless, already we can have a new axiom. The new axioms would be that some Boolean functions have non-trivial combination complexity. That's what I call an axiom that has to do with information, an axiom of physics that has to do with information. But this axiom is not sufficient, as I just told you. It's not sufficient because the consequence would just be that you cannot have, that quantum mechanics is not maximally non-local. It would not say why it's non-local at the point where it is. All right. Good. I said that. So that's where I come in. With a paper I wrote with Alain Tap and Harry Berman and a bunch of other co-authors. What we did was to consider what happens if the non-local box, if you were satisfied with doing this combination complexity with and get the outcome, get the remember you it's a Boolean function you want to compute. Any Boolean function can be computed with the probability 1/2 of success. Don't look at your input, toss a coin. So if you can do any better than 50% probability of success, or more precisely, any better than a fixed constant above 50% probability of success, then you would do something interesting about computing this function. So what we did here was to relax the goal of combination complexity and allow and be satisfied with any answer which is better than 50%, as I said, better than a constant bigger than 50%. From this, what we were able to do is to give this partial answer. Sorry. This is good. I'm running out of time, so I'll just skip through the formal definitions. But again, we want to compute with probability p bigger than 1/2 for a Boolean function, and we say that it's probabilistically trivial if it can be done with a single bit. And the theorem is, well, what's the theorem? First, there's a first theorem, which is maybe surprising, not so hard, but very surprising, I think, that all Boolean functions can be computed with probability, well, 1/2 is not surprising, I told you, toss a coin. Greater than 1/2, all Boolean functions can be computed with probability strictly bigger than 1/2 with no communication. With one bit of communication. So it's, it sounds like I'm saying it's trivial, but it's not. This is a mistake. This is one bit of communication for all Boolean functions. But it's bigger than 1/2. It's not bigger than the constant bigger than 1/2. Big difference. It's going to be bigger than 1/2, but the bigger is the input, the more close to 1/2 it will be. It's exponentially close to 1/2 in the length of the input. So it's not bigger than the constant bigger than 1/2. And this can be done with a single bit of communication, even classically, purely classically. However, even if you have entanglement, some Boolean functions cannot be computed with a probability bigger than a constant bigger than 1/2. Therefore, they are not probabilistically trivial. And the theorem here is that, well, what's the theorem? Could we prove that all Boolean functions would become trivial if you had imperfect boxes available that work 75% of the time? Could we prove that? Well, of course not, because in the classical world, you can get this 75% probability of success for non-local boxes, and yet you cannot get probabilistically trivial communication. So that's not possible. How about 85%? No, because with quantum mechanics, you can get 85% non-local boxes, and yet you still cannot get probabilistically trivial communication. And the nice theorem, what we would like to have and don't have, what we would like to have, this would explain. If we had this theorem, it would explain Searles's mind. It would explain why God chose 85% as the best simulation of nanocold boxes allowed by his in his universe, in quantum mechanics. If we could prove that as soon that as soon as we would have a universe in which non-local boxes can be simulated with a probability ever so slightly bigger than 85%, where, of course, I really mean cosine square of pi over 8, that if you could simulate non-local boxes in some universe with any probability ever so slightly bigger than this 85% bound of Thurlson, if you could, then all Boolean functions would become probabilistically trivial to compute in terms of combination complexity. If we had this theorem, then we could take the axiom. Then we would have this axiom that we're after. Axiom, there are Boolean functions that cannot be computed probabilistically with only one bit of communication. That's a very natural axiom for a computer scientist. And from this axiom, we could derive Thurlson's bound. Unfortunately, we have not been able to prove this. All we could do, well, we don't know, would be wonderful. But in fact, we were able to prove that if you could simulate a non-local box with a 91 probability of success, if you could do that, then all Boolean functions would become probabilistically trivial. And there's a gap between 85 and 91, which no one, best of my knowledge, has filled in yet. But at least 91% is less than 100. It explains why, it explains, still, quote, explains why, not only why God decided that you could not have perfect non-local boxes, but that you could not even have 91% perfect non-local boxes. It does not explain Thurlson's bound of 85%. So it's kind of a partial success. And from there, using a completely different approach, that's a paper in Nature, Marcin Pawłowski and co-authors, have proposed an information theoretic principle, which they call the causality principle. And the causality principle is something which really has to do with information. It's the kind of thing I like. So they postulated this causality principle. It's a principle they can prove from quantum mechanics. But that's not what we want to do. Of course, it's nice that we know it's true with quantum mechanics. But the point of Pawlowski is that if you take that as a postulate, then you can prove this 85% bound of Thurlson's. It was not my intention to give any detailed explanation of what is the causality principle. Just want to mention that it exists, and I find it very, very exciting. And so from this principle, in fact, it's even better. From the causality principle, they're able to prove that in an infinite universe, you cannot have non-local boxes better than cosine square pi over 8. However, if the universe is not infinite, if from any fixed size universe, you can only get to a bound which is somewhat bigger than 85%. And the bound you get on the how good a non-local box you can build converges to Thurlson's bound as the universe becomes infinite. Kind of intriguing and lots of fun, I think. So again, this is the type of thing I like. More recently, there's been two pieces of work. I'm skipping over a lot of work that many of you have done. Please excuse me. Again, I know that I will learn a lot of things during the week from you. Let me just end on two of the most recent attempts. They might be better. In fact, they might be more than just attempts. They might be successes. Axiomatizing quantum mechanics, or at least the part of quantum mechanics of interest to quantum information theorists, based purely on quantum information. One of them is Masinus and Müller. Lewis and Marcus. Marcus, I think Marcus will talk about this here, maybe even today. In this case, they were able to base quantum mechanics on four principles. I'll skip the detail, and we'll hear about it anyways today. But these four requirements imply quantum mechanics. And whether or not you want to consider the last one as being information theory is up to you. But from these four principles, we get a mathematical derivation of quantum information. And the other one that I just want to mention before I stop is due to our main organizer and co-authors. So Giulio Caribella and his co-authors have also derived quantum mechanics based on, in this case, six. These five, I'm sorry to pull the rug under Giulio's co-author who will give this talk today, I think. So from these five principles, we can get this is consistent with both classical and quantum physics, and you get a lot of things. And if you add entanglement, if you add purification, then you get a whole of quantum, then you get only quantum mechanics as a solution. So we'll hear more about that today, but that's a beautiful example of what I mean by rederiving quantum mechanics from information theory axioms. All right, I'll stop here. I'm certainly not saying that we should all go home because the question's solved, but there's been significant, wonderful progress in the past 10 years ever since Chris and I started thinking about these things and other people's and Wheeler before us. And I'm sure that by the end of the week, we will have made even more great progress towards the Holy Grail. Thank you very much.
So we started a couple of minutes late. I think we have time for one question. It's perfectly clear.
Yeah.
In that case, let's go to coffee and meet back here in half an hour.